stations. Cax's hands clenched as the Lynx maneuvered, its slow coal jets pushing them with the sway of an ocean-going vessel.
"You thinking what I'm thinking?" Cax asked.
She nodded. "They've configured for heavy defense, sir."
"See if you can get a count. The captain will want to know how many black bodies are out there before the Lynx gets too much closer."
"Yes, sir, but I'll bet you right now there's at least 100.
100?
If you take a..." Suddenly a rush of noise exploded through the room. A searing wind struck Tyre, throwing her from her webbing to the floor. Her exposed skin, hands and cheeks were being scoured. Her mouth and eyes clenched instinctively shut. Her ears popped as the air pressure plummeted. A burning sound reached her ears through the thin air, and she felt heat on her hands and face. Ensign Amanda Tyre, like every recruit to the Navy, had gone through dozens of decompression drills. She knew well the expansion of the chest, the screaming pain of ears and eyes. But this was her first time to experience the event in battle. It felt as if some demon were astride her, crushing the breath from her body. Tyre remembered the symbol on the Academy's decompression drill room door. The asphyx, the spirit that visits the dying to steal their last breath. Through the haze of synesthesia, she had a sudden vision of the asphyx, the blank eyes, the yawning mouth, hungry for her life. Then she command gestured, clearing her data mask of all synesthesia, and saw that it was Cax's face before her. He had fallen to the deck next to her. But even in primary vision, his face remained horrifying, burned and bleeding, the flesh peeling from it as if stripped by hungry insects.
"Glass," he said, his voice ravaged.
Tyre rolled out from under him. As her hands sought purchase on the tilting deck, she felt the grit of tiny bits of broken glass cutting into her palms. Her pressure uniform was torn and felt invaded with some sharp presence, like the insinuating fingers of fiberglass against the skin. The other three in the DA room were stunned, their faces and arms cut with thousands of tiny nicks. The phosphorus fire had burned itself out too quickly to hurt them. Rating Rogers, still in his webbing, coughed as he spoke.
"It's glass, from the optical core next door."
He pointed to the access tube, from which coiled a bright, heavy mist, half vapor and half dust. Of course. Data analysis was adjacent to one of the Lynx's processing towers, a column of dense optical silicon and phosphorus. Tyre hadn't been following the Lynx's defensive status, so she brought up the diagnostic channel in synesthesia. A number of projectiles had plunged through the vessel. That explained the momentary blaze. The quantum computers of the Lynx used phosphorus atoms suspended in silicon as qubits. Free, the phosphorus was flammable, even in what little oxygen there'd been for the agonizing seconds of decompression. Tyre covered her mouth with a loose flap of uniform to ward off the glass vapor hanging in the air. Looked again to Cax. His eyes were clenched shut and bleeding. He'd been the only one in the station without full-strength heads-ups covering his upper face, and his body had shielded hers from the blast of glass and burning phosphorus.
"Medical! Medical!"
Tyre said, her voice gritty and plaintive from the glass dust she'd inhaled.
"We need Major Medical in DA Station 1, Deck 14.
She heard the background murmur of other stations begging for medical assistance. Data Master Cax reached out a bloody hand and clenched Tyre's ankle, coughing. She knelt beside him.
"Don't try to talk, sir," she said. "The black bodies, Tyre. Keep looking," he managed.
She glanced around at her crewmates, realizing that the Lynx was still in battle. With Cax out, she was in command now. The data from Master Pilot Marx's scout was invaluable, and he was far too busy flying to grasp its tactical implications.
"Rogers, try to help the data master," she commanded. "You two, back to your stations."
Still in shock, her crewmates moved numbly to follow her orders. Tyre sank into her webbing and flipped back to second sight. She gestured with bloody hands and adopted the scout drone's viewpoint again. Master Pilot Marx was under fire. Pilot. Marx discovered that he was still alive. A small cleaning robot moved beneath his feet, sucking up the thin acid bile on the floor with a gurgling sound that set his stomach flopping again. His hands were shaking and his ears rang from some nearby decompression. The Lynx had been hit, all right. But somehow Zaya had kept them alive. The strike certainly hadn't numbered 5,000 flockers. It had sounded like only 10 or so. Mark scanned the icons of internal diagnostics. There were no more than 20 crewmen dead. He turned his eyes from the display before he could recognize any names. Later. What mattered most was that Mark's control hardware, the translite array that connected him with the drone complement, was still functional. He could still see from the scout drone's perspective, if only fuzzily. He checked the clock. Another 30 seconds remained before his foremost drones passed the Rick's battlecruiser and became irrelevant to the battle. There was still a chance. But the question remained, how to disintegrate the dead sandcaster? Marx considered his remaining assets. Only 4 drones were left inside the Rick's defenses that could respond to his orders. The scout itself tumbling with no reaction drive. The 2 stealth penetrators, smaller than dribble hoop balls. And the decoy, weaponless. And if any of them switched on active sensors or accelerated noticeably, the Rick's monitor drones would shred it within seconds. He could see the sentinels now as the scout neared the hot background of the receiver array. Rank after rank of black body monitor drones, dark spots against its reflective surface. Good God, Marx thought. Other than a few thousand flockers and hunter drones, the battlecruiser's drone complement had been committed almost entirely to defensive weaponry. The Rick's captain had prioritized the receiver array above everything else. He shook his head. The Lynx had never had a chance. Looking at the ranks of fearsome monitors, Marx envied their firepower. If he could just take over a few of the blackbody drones and turn their weapons back on the receiver. Then the master pilot realized what he had to do. It was simplicity itself. He watched the trajectories of his 4 drones as they converged, growing nearer to each other as they drifted toward the Rick's battlecruiser. The decoy was in front. The little drone was designed to burst a wide range of EM every few minutes, drawing fire away from more vital targets. When it wasn't screaming, it was stealthy, with passive sensors and line-of-sight transmission. Marx had kept the decoy silent so far, but now he saw what to do with it. The stealth drones were the only thing he could move without detection. They were equipped with cold jets, slow but radiation silent. He eased one alongside the decoy drone, bringing the 2 into soft contact. His view might be blurry and vague, but at under 10 meters per second, Marx could have rammed a hummingbird. The master pilot shoved the decoy with the stealth drone, pushed it on a new vector toward the sandcaster. He cursed, pushing the plodding cold jets to their maximums. In another 20 seconds, his little formation would be hurtling uselessly past the battlecruiser. Marx waited until the decoy was a bare kilometer from the sandcaster, then fired its reaction drive. It barreled in toward the sandcaster drone in decoy mode, screaming bloody murder. Suddenly, Marx could see. The decoy was flooding the area with EM, painting everything within light seconds across the whole spectrum. To the Ricks, it must have seemed as if a fleet of drones had popped up from nowhere. The blackbody monitors wasted no time responding. Ripples of their slugs arced beautifully across space, lit like tracer bullets by the decoy's sensory howl. The rain of slugs swept across the stealth penetrator first, then found the decoy, and things were dark for a moment. But seconds later, Mark saw the blast of the sandcaster being hit, pulped, shredded by the depleted uranium slugs. Perfect, he whispered as a sequence of explosions flared in synesthesia. The blinded sandcaster was still loaded with reaction mass. The drone blazed with the dirty fuel of its self-propelling canisters. It popped again and again like a sackful of fragmentation grenades. The Ricks had done Marx's work for him. The sand cloud expanded into a huge misshapen ball, a time-lapse amoeba festooned with reaching pseudopods. It was almost 4,000 kilometers across when it struck the receiver array, at a relative velocity of 3,000 clicks per second. The hail of slugs had also imparted lateral velocity to the cloud, and it swept across the array like a sirocco. Marx switched on his scout's active sensors, letting the Lynx's computers record the damage in maximum detail. He leaned back to savor the light show, the vast receiver array flickering from end to end, a mica desert struck by the morning sun. The huge object began to fold, a giant piece of fabric twisting in the wind. Then fire from the blackbody drones found the pulsing scout, and Marx's view snapped to dead channel blue. He brought up Hobbs's line. Master pilot reporting mission accomplished, he said. The Rick's receiver array has been destroyed. Data analyst. Tyre prioritized Marx's signal, recording at maximum resolution. Finally, a good look at the enemy battlecruiser. It only lasted a few seconds. The projectile fire from a dozen black bodies raked across Marx's forward drones, tearing them to pieces. The sand canister exploded. Tyre watched with her mouth agape as the sand tore across the Rick's receiver array. "He got it!" she cried. Then the arc of fire moved inexorably toward the scout drone itself. In the seconds before the signal was extinguished, the tearing megastructure caught the light of the Legis sun, and an awesome sight was revealed. Ensign Tyre's ragged breath halted as she took it in. She had assumed that Marx's drones had hit a concentration of black bodies, a random clumping of firepower. Even the largest Rick's ships only traveled with a few dozens of the black body monitors. The heavy metal ammunition they carried was bulky, they were difficult to maintain, and were primarily a defensive weapon. But revealed against the bright background of the crumpling array was a host of monitors. They stretched across its shining expanse in a vast hexagonal pattern. Hundreds of them. Then synesthesia went dark. Marx's drone had finally died. Ensign Tyre heard a gurgle from Data Master Kax at her feet, but she ignored the grim sound. Tyre rewound the scout's viewpoint stream a few seconds and froze it on a frame in which the Legis sun had revealed the monitor drones. Ensign Tyre blinked as she looked at them. They were short-range weapons primarily for defense. They had no drives and little intelligence, just lots and lots of projectile firepower. If a small warship like the Lynx were to stumble amongst hundreds of them, it would be torn to pieces by their collective kinetic attack. And the Lynx was headed straight for the battlecruiser and into the intervening field of black bodies, unaware of their deadly, silent presence. She had to alert the captain. Tyre opened a line to Hobbs. The executive officer did not immediately respond. There were probably a dozen crew of superior rank clamoring for her attention. Tyre waited, the seconds ticking away, the Lynx hurtling toward the deadly black body drones, 3,000 kilometers closer every second. Priority, priority! The priority icon appeared before her in second sight. The icon was for extreme emergencies only, a term that held awesome power here in data analysis. Kax had never used it. Tyre had certainly never thought to invoke it herself. It was the data master's prerogative. And if she were wrong about what the vast array of drones meant, misuse of the priority icon in battle would be a terrible mark against her forever. Tyre stared at the frozen image again. Hundreds of them, she reminded herself. The data were unambiguous. She switched to the diagnostic channel again. There were casualties all across the ship, hull and equipment damage, even fatalities. It could be minutes before Hobbs responded to a lowly ensign. Tyre put out her trembling and bloody hand to the icon. Not authorized, the icon blinked. She swore. Kax was still alive and on station. As far as the Lynx was concerned, he was still in command and was the only analyst qualified to make this judgment. Tyre cleared her second sight and looked down to where Rogers cradled the data master's head. Kax seemed hardly to have a face at all. For a fleeting moment, she wondered if he still had second sight, even though his eyes were destroyed. There wasn't time to ask. Kax could hardly breathe. He couldn't be thinking clearly with an injury like that. Rogers, she ordered, pull the data master out of the room. What? Pick him up and drag him from the room. Get him off the station. Tyre said it with all the force she could manage. Her ragged voice gave the words an authority she didn't feel. Rogers hesitated, looking at the other two ratings. Rogers, the Lynx won't recognize my rank with him in here. But there's more glass out. Do it! Rogers jumped, then stooped to gingerly lift the wounded Kax. He pulled the bloody man toward the doorway, his shredded uniform scraping across the glass and out into the access shaft. Tyre breathed deep and touched the priority icon again. Please listen, she murmured to herself. The icon shifted in the air, folding into a bright point, and requested her missive. She attached the compiled frame showing the host of blackbody drones and gestured the send command. A few seconds later, Hobbs's voice responded. My God, the exo said. Tyre breathed a sigh of relief at the woman's tone. At least Hobbs understood. Where the hell's Kax? Injured. Blind, I think. Shit. Get up to the captain's planning room, then, the executive officer ordered, and get ready to explain this. Aye, aye. We'll have to accelerate immediately. We'll lose the manifold for good. Hobbs continued, talking half to herself. You better be on the mark with this, Tyre. Tyre swallowed as she pulled herself from the webbing. If she was wrong, her career was ruined. If she was right, the Lynx was in very deep trouble. Senator. They looked up at her with startled expressions, curious and wary. Their eyes reflected the hovering globe that lit her path, igniting with the crimson flash of night predators. Nara Oxum wondered if small rodents were ever let loose in the Diamond Palace's darkened halls, entertainment for the Emperor's pets. Of course, it seemed unlikely that risen animals would make very aggressive hunters. As she passed, the felines remained piled together on the low window couch, regally watchful, but as soporific as fat old Toms. Perhaps like dead humans, they were content to contemplate black paintings and go on endless pilgrimages. Nara could see the ridges of the symbiont along the feline's spines, payment for the cruelty their kind had suffered during the holy experiments. They were dead things, she reminded herself. Senator, the inhuman voice came out of darkness, and Oxum started. My apologies, Senator Oxum. The representative from the plague axis stepped to the edge of her globe's light, but remained politely distant. My biosuit allows me a certain level of night vision. I had forgotten you couldn't see me. The slight hiss of the biosuit's filters was barely audible in the silent hallway. Nara tried not to imagine the representative's diseases straining to escape, to infect her, to propagate across the human species. So you can see in the dark, not unlike the Sovereign's house pets, she said, gesturing at the flashing eyes. There was a pause. Had her insult found its mark? Through the opaque faceplate, the representative's expression was invisible. They had sat on the war council together for weeks now, but Nara didn't even know if the thing inside the suit was male or female. Whatever it was, it had cast the deciding vote in favor of the Emperor's genocide. Except that those cats will live forever, Nara Oxum. I shall not. The people of the Plague Axis could not take the symbiont, which resisted all disease and physical defect as part of its cure for death. For that reason, Oxum and her party had counted the Axis on the side of the living, allies against the Emperor. It hadn't worked out that way. Oxum shrugged. Neither shall I. She turned and walked toward the council chamber. Senator, the representative called softly. The Sovereign requests we attend him, she answered without stopping. The soft, pearly floor of the council chamber glowed coolly in the Diamond Palace's night. The dead never liked bright rooms at any time, but the lighting in grey places always varied slowly, reflecting daily and seasonal shifts, even equinoctial precession on more eccentric planets. Senator Oxum and the Plague Axis representative were the last of the 9 councillors to arrive. The dead admiral hardly waited for them to settle before beginning her speech. There is news from Legius. Nara closed her eyes and took a deep breath, then forced herself to watch. The air screen filled with a familiar schematic. The decelerating Rix battlecruiser arcing toward Legius, the hook-shaped path of the Lynx darting out to engage it as far from the planet as possible. At this system-sized scale, the 2 trajectories were touching now. Nara's sudden dose of apathy would take some time to wear off, so she watched the faces of her colleagues through the translucent image. The other pink senators, Federalist and Utopian, and the plutocrat, Axe Milk, wore harried and sleepless looks. Even the loyalist Henders looked nervous, unready to learn that he had voted for mass murder. The faces of 3 dead members of the War Council were like stone. The Admiral spoke evenly, the General sat at attention, the risen Sovereign stared into the middle distance over Nara's head. She could feel nothing but a lifetime spent comparing what eyes and empathy told her had given Nara an instinct for reading bodies and faces. Even with her ability dampened, the aspects of the dead men and woman betrayed disquiet. Something had gone wrong. The Lynx and the Rix engaged some 30 minutes ago, the dead admiral continued. At last report, the 2 ships have reached second contact. Nara's jaw tightened. First contact was when the outer drone clouds overlapped, with shots fired between them. Second contact meant that the primaries, the Lynx and the Rix warship proper, had engaged each other's drones. Beginning with second contact, human lives were lost.
The Lynx has suffered casualties, but has thus far managed to survive. Any of those casualties might be Laurent, Nara thought, but surely the Admiral would mention it if the ship's captain was dead. More importantly, the Lynx's drones have succeeded in the primary goal of the attack, destroying the Rick's receiver array. At this point, it seems that the Legis mind will remain isolated without further action on our part. The Admiral was silent for a moment, letting the news sink in. Nara saw her own hesitation on the other living counselors' faces. None of them believed it yet. They were waiting for some awful reversal in the Admiral's statement. But the dead woman's silence lengthened, and they realized it was true. There was no reason to obliterate the compound mind. There would be no EMP attack, no 100 million dead. Laurent had saved them all. The War Council stirred all at once, like people waking from a nightmare. The Loyalist Henders put his head in his hands, an exhausted and undisguised gesture, and even the Plague Axis representative's biosuit slumped with what had to be relief. The other senators and Milk turned to Nara Oxum, daring to show their respect. Nara let nothing she felt reach her face. For her, more than any of them, this had been personal. She would allow herself emotions later. "We are happy with this victory, of course," the Emperor said. He was lying, Nara was certain. She had seen it in him, and in his dead soldiers. They had wanted Zai to fail. "And more important than any victory, we rest assured that this council was ready to make the necessary sacrifice." For the first time ever, Nara saw the Sovereign's praise fall flat. None of the living members had been ready to watch what the War Council had voted for. The Emperor had lost something here. "We must congratulate this council for having made the right decision. However pleased we are, it didn't come to action." There was an edge in his voice. Anyone could hear it. Nara Oxum had grown to know the Emperor, this young-looking, undead man, and to understand his fixation with the Ricks. Their compound minds were a counter-god to his own false divinity. He was as jealous as any petty deity, and Nara Oxum was a politician who understood egomania, no matter how grossly exaggerated. But over the last few days, she had seen fear in him, not hatred. What could terrify the Emperor of 80 worlds so much that only genocide would suffice? "We owe Zai a debt," the Plague representative said. There were nods of agreement. The Sovereign turned to look at the biosuit, the movement of his head as slow as some ancient lizard. "We have already elevated him," the Emperor said coldly, "and pardoned him after our sister's death. Perhaps it was his debt to pay." "Still, Majesty," the Utopian senator said, "an entire world has been saved from grievous harm." "Indeed," the Federalist said.
"I agree,"
Axmilk added.
"May I remind you of the 100-year rule?" the Sovereign said. "None of us can speak of what Zai prevented, not for a century."
"But he has still won a great victory," the Plague representative said. "An auspicious beginning to this war." Nara almost let herself smile. For the first time since the Council was formed, the others dared to contradict the Emperor. Not only Zai had won this battle, the living members of the War Council had as well. But the dead Admiral interrupted.
"We cannot publicly declare Zai's victory yet. Third contact will come in another 20 minutes. It seems unlikely the Lynx will survive."
Nara swallowed. Third contact was when the two primaries engaged directly, ship to ship, without their drones between them. "Why would there be a third contact, Admiral?" she asked. "With the array destroyed, surely the Lynx will make its escape. It's smaller, faster." The Admiral gestured, and the airscreen image zoomed. Vector lines were added, arcing through intersections like crossed scimitars.
"Captain Zai made his attack at a high relative velocity to get his drones past the Rick's defenses and at the array. At this point, the two ships are moving toward each other, too fast for the Lynx to make much of an escape. In the service of the Emperor and this council, Zai has sealed his own fate."
"In war, there are always sacrifices," the Emperor sighed.
Nara forced herself not to utter the cry she felt building. The elation of a few moments ago drained away, her heart turning cold. One way or another, these dead men would have their revenge against Laurent. It was as if the Emperor himself had decreed the law of inertia, just to spite Zai's heroism and see him killed.
She was utterly selfish, Nara tried to tell herself, to think only of one man when millions had been saved, when the Lynx carried 300. But for Nara, the battle was lost if Laurent wasn't coming home. Commando. The call from Alexander eventually came. The few phones that Herd had spared dissection rang in unison, then beeped out a simple coded sequence from the one-time pad she shared with Alexander. The battle in space had gone badly, and her assistance was required. The entanglement facility had to be liberated for the compound mine's use. The call hadn't awakened Rana, Herd realized with bittersweet relief. The few novels and plays she'd read suggested that the farewell rituals of Imperial humanity and those of the Ricks were incompatible. And this would be a deep goodbye. Either of them, perhaps both, might die in the next 10 hours. Herd pulled herself closer to the woman's soft, warm body. How humanity raged against its environment, she thought, each body demanding its own pocket of heat, and at a temperature so perversely exact. 5 degrees in either direction spelled death. So prideful, yet so fragile. The rattle in Rana's breathing sounded worse. The rhythm was even, but Herd detected the slightest increase of its tempo from a few hours ago. The woman's breath quickened as the volume of her functioning lung decreased. The pulsatile nature of her lover's physiology always fascinated Herd. The rhythms of circulation, breath, menstruation, and sleep had an alien grandeur, like the ancient symmetries expressed in the brief lives of particles or in the stately motions of planets. Herd was Rix, her heart a screw, her lungs continuous filters, her ovaries in cold storage back on her home orbital. And those cycles of the Rick's body that had escaped upgrade could be modulated as easily as the speed of an engine. But the interlocking patterns that constituted Rana Harta's aliveness seemed sovereign as nature. Herd could not imagine them simply winding down into awful, inescapable silence. Of course, the Rick's woman knew how to save her lover, understood, at least abstractly, the price of the delicate and precious life beside her. She could always surrender to the Imperials, giving Rana to their doctors and herself to the military. Herd pondered what it would be like to abandon Alexander at this critical moment. Despite what the Empire called the Ricks, they were no cult. Members were free to rejoin humanity. Over the last few centuries, a dozen or so even had. But Herd would find no freedom in Imperial hands. The risen Empire had never taken a Ricks prisoner of war unless a few frozen and decompressed bodies plucked from hard space were counted. They would interrogate her, mind-sweep her, test her mercilessly, and finally dissect the prostheses that she considered unambiguously to be herself. And although they would save Rana Harta's body, they had proven themselves unfit wardens of her soul. For 27 years, their clumsy system of wealth distribution had left Rana to her own devices. A borderline depressive, fearful, and indecisive, naive in some ways and magnificently savant in others, Rana was a raw, rare, defenseless gem. But they had let her drift, a cog in the Imperial machine. They had exploited what little of her abilities required no training and given nothing in return. Both systems of the 80 worlds, the hierarchy of the Empire and the wild purity of the capital, had one appetite in common. They fed on the weak. The help Rana needed was simple, a mere dopamine adjustment, and the manic depression that had scarred her life had been easily vanquished. But such treatment wasn't available to the class she had been born into. She was the victim of the most parochial of economic arrangements. Their barbarism wasn't even efficient. With her abilities, she would have been a valuable asset, but the Imperials imagined it cheaper and easier to let her suffer. When Herd's internal tirade ended, she allowed herself a rueful smile. Who was she to take the Empire to task? She had kidnapped this woman, drugged her, put her in harm's way, taken Rana to her death. But at least she had understood the clever, marvelous thing that Rana Harta was. Herd pressed her lips gingerly to the back of Rana's neck, smelled the warm, human complexity of her. Then the commando crept from bed. Executive Officer. A gravity ghost drifted through the command bridge. The shudder described a textbook bell curve, slowly building and receding as if some ancient steam train were rumbling past. No one spoke until the event was over. The Lynx was accelerating at 18 G's away from the battlecruiser, pushing as hard as its gravity generators could compensate for. The assembled officers knew that if the generators suddenly failed, they would all be unconscious in seconds, crushed by their own suddenly tremendous weight. The Lynx's AI would recognize the problem and shut its engines down automatically, but by then...